Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with escalating atrocities in Syria, where the army and the Shabiha death squads are poised to exterminate the town of Hafa and have the city of Homs under siege. Henri Barkey, a former member of the United States State Department policy planning staff on the Middle East, joins us to discuss the failed mediation by Kofi Annan, whose UN military observers are being denied access to the killing fields and are often shot at by Assad's forces. Then we will speak with Christine Ferguson, the principal author of the Republican healthcare plan that was adopted by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts and later by President Obama. She was the commissioner of the Department of Public Health Services in Massachusetts under Governor Romney, and we will discuss what will happen if some or all of Obama's Affordable Care Act is struck down by the Supreme Court. Then finally, Andy Kroll, a staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones, joins us. He has an article in the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, Why Electoral Politics Sold Out the Popular Uprising in the Badger State, and Why It Is Not Over. We will discuss why he considers the recall detrimental to a popular uprising and why much of the Occupy movement and some progressives consider electoral politics irrelevant. Joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. He recently had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And it does seem that the city of Homs is under siege with fairly heavy military equipment being used on the civilian population. And there are also reports of the town on the Mediterranean coast in the Alawite area that's under siege as well. Is this something that we should be considering worse than what's happened? Or is this just an example of how things are just going to get grimmer and grimmer?
Well, I think we're seeing the cycle of violence now escalating. I mean, I think one way of looking at it is to say that maybe what the Syrian regime is doing is this is an all-out, last-minute-ditch effort to save the regime by essentially intimidating the opposition. And I think they're going to fail because clearly the opposition has not been intimidated so far. In fact, it's getting stronger, better organized, there are more defections, and they are more better coordinated. But I think this is going to go for a long time. A lot of blood is going to be spilled. There is no alternative at the moment. The Annan plan was not really much of a plan. It was a face-saving device, essentially, to buy some time to see if people can get organized. The regime wanted it because it gave them time to repress the opposition. The outside powers, who do not want to intervene, essentially thought this was a good enough plan, especially since the Russians don't want to do anything. So I think we're in a major quagmire, and unless there's some break on the diplomatic front, I don't see this being resolved. And here, look, I think we need to start looking at alternative solutions. I mean, one of the things that we have seen develop is really this animosity between Washington and Moscow. I mean, the Russians are organizing a conference tomorrow to which the Americans are not invited. Secretary Clinton last week essentially lambasted the Russians for being participants in the massacres. This is all good and true, but the problem is, without the Russians, we're not going to get anywhere. So maybe it's time to figure out solutions to the Russians. And I think one of the interesting things to think about Russia is that the Russians, and not the Soviet Union, the Russians historically have had an interest in the Christian minorities of the Levant. Back in the 18th century, they had forced the Ottomans to let them be the protectors of the Christians in the Ottoman Empire. So, and when you look at the Orthodox Church in Russia, it's a major actor. It wants to protect the Christians. And this is important for the Russians. And maybe the way to think about this is to give essentially the Russians not just a role in terms of protecting the Christians in Syria, but also protecting the Alawites. I mean, the Alawite community, which is backing Assad at the moment, they're the 12% of the population. Their backs are against the wall. They think if there's regime change, they're going to be all killed. So we need to figure out a way of reassuring them and say, and so that they will dissociate themselves from the regime. So they will, and maybe the best way to do it is by bringing the Russians in, and essentially, since the Russians are trusted both by the Christian minority in Syria and the Alawites, maybe give the Russians a role where they become the peacekeepers. We can think of Russian peacekeepers being positioned in all those places where the Alawites are in significant majority or plurality, also in Damascus, where you have a large Christian population. In other words, try to figure out ways to separate the Russians from the regime, and maybe this is the way. I mean, the Russians are looking for a role, and the Russians are trying to say, look, we're a big power, you cannot ignore us. And maybe this is a way. I'm not saying this is the panacea. We need to think of different ways in which to work this problem. At the moment, all that's going to happen is more bloodshed. That is the only thing we know for sure.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. So you're suggesting then, Henri Barkey, that there's more to Russian foreign policy than Vladimir Putin. There's no secret that Putin is feeling kind of churlish towards the United States. He blamed them for the protest movement that sprung up as a result of the perception on the part of a lot of Russians that the election that re-elected him was a fraud, and his party, United Russia, is colloquially referred to as the party of crooks and swindlers. So, I mean, this is not about one man being peeved at the United States.
No. I think you have to factor in domestic public opinion in Russia. I think it's that public opinion is dead against an American intervention in Syria. Part of that public opinion is driven by this Christian minority issue. Part of it is anti-Americanism, especially because the regime spews so much anti-Americanism. And partially it's this need for Russia to stop being the footnote to history in the 21st century. And the Russians perceive the Americans and the West essentially as having relegated them to a minor role, or if no role in international politics. And this is their way of saying, show us some respect. I mean, to go back to Rodney Dangerfield, they want respect. And one way of accommodating them is by giving them a role in Syria. The Russians are worried not just about the minorities there, but they're also worried about the contracts, the access to bases. Syria was their most important client state. And denying them that is not going to help us convince the Russians to participate. Now, we can push the Russians. We can, in that LA Times article that you referenced, you know, one of the arguments I made was, look, maybe we can shame them by showing all the real life pictures of the calamity that's befalling the civilian population in Syria. The more I thought about it, maybe we need to figure out a way to bring the Russians in instead of pushing them out and always bandwagoning against them. Mm. And
well, do you think it was a mistake then from the beginning to not have kept this as a humanitarian issue rather than a regime change issue? After all, that was the way that the Libyan intervention was at least framed, although the Russians felt that even though they signed up on it, they felt buyer's remorse. What's your sense of whether the U.S. has framed it and concentrated too much on regime change?
Well, look, let's be honest here. In Syria, you're not going to have change without regime change. The regime is genetically opposed to giving up power in any shape or form. The truth is, everybody tried to convince him, to convince Bashar Assad at the beginning to relax a little bit, and he refused. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason the Turks turned against him is because, you know, all their entities essentially fell on deaf ears.
Right.
And so the Bashar Assad and his regime have had ample opportunity to change their ways, and they haven't because they really are convinced that if they do, they will lose power, and the family especially will lose power. But I think we've crossed the Rubicon now. I think there will not be peace in Syria without regime change. That doesn't mean that what that means is the Ba'athi regime and Assad will have to go. But it doesn't necessarily mean that Syria is going to be a democracy tomorrow. It doesn't mean that it's going to be at peace at home. I mean, I think it will need a lot of care and a lot of intervention from the outside to help matters. But what we do know for sure is without a change in the regime, there won't be peace. And I think the Russians also realize that. I mean, I think but the Russians are stuck because they realize that they have stuck their neck out so much for Bashar that any regime change will be disastrous for them, because whoever comes to power after overthrowing Bashar is going to take it out on the Russians.
But this is hardly a surprise. This regime, of course, it's killed perhaps up to 15,000 people since March of 2011. But in Hama, back in, 82, Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, or through his brother, who lives in comfortable exile in London, who was the actual has blood, the you know, on the spot blood in his hands, if you will. They murdered between 20,000 and 30,000 people. I mean that is their MO, isn't it? They're a minority regime who basically have a compact with the public. You either play along with us and we'll have a modus vivendi, but if you ever oppose us, we'll kill you.
Right, but first of all, I don't know how many people died in Hama. Some estimates say 9,000, some say 12,000. I mean, there was never an accurate count, and there can never be an accurate count. That said, the similarities in some ways are eerie because, again, it's Bashar's brother, Maher, who's conducting most of these operations. I mean, it looks like they're always outsourced to the brother for some reason. That said, 1982, when the Hama massacre happened, and 2012 are two very different time periods.
So
now we see everything live on camera. When Hama happened, people had an inkling of what was going on and weren't even sure. I think Tom Friedman in his book talks about driving by and seeing all those artillery pieces pointing towards the center of the city. But by and large, the rest of the world, except maybe intelligence agencies, did not know anything about this. Now everybody knows. And if this is happening in real time, in real pictures, and we can see it. So in that sense, what they could get away with in 1982, they can't get away with anymore. And that's why I'm saying that this regime is done. The question is, they don't have a choice but to fight. I mean, the regime doesn't have another choice.
But does that extend to the Alawites, the 12 to 15%? In other words, are they so tied in with this dynamic of preemptive violence?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. I mean, I think what the West and other countries in the Middle East need to do is to create the conditions whereby the Alawites switch their allegiance from the family, from the Assad family, to the state, to some other entity. Right? At the moment, they are completely tied to the family, because the family and the state are the same thing. So I think what we need to do is figure out a way for the Alawites essentially to shift their allegiance away from Assad, but not necessarily away from their own communities, their own the sense of well-being and sense of identity. Right? But to do that, we need to create something else. And that we cannot do in Syria because nobody's on the ground in Syria. So that's why I'm turning back to the Russians and thinking that maybe the Russians are the ones who can do it. We cannot do it for sure.
And what about the Chinese?
At the moment,
But sorry to interrupt, Ori Baki, but what about the Chinese? They're the ones, after all, that cast the two vetoes that prevented any other...
The Russians have a history in Syria.
Right, I see.
The Russians have been part of Syria in many ways, good or bad. The Russians have bases in Syria. And the Russians are the one... I mean, people look at the Chinese essentially as a second fiddle to Moscow. They're not the real serious actor here. It's the Russians. And as I said, I mean, the Russians do have a history of involvement with the Christian communities of the Middle East that goes back to 1774, when it was the first time they got they forced the Ottoman Empire to concede to them that they had a role to play in Ottoman territories to protect the Christians.
And that's through the Eastern Church, right?
Think about that historical this empire, this memory of the empire, memory of being a great power. This is also a way of bringing the Russians and saying, look, you're still important. You still have a role to play. And maybe that will appeal, and that will appeal to not just to Putin, but also the Orthodox Church in Russia that is increasingly being very influential in these issues.
So, Ori Baki, it does seem, of course, that we're definitely talking, both the Russians and the US and the UK are talking past each other. The UK foreign minister is now talking about the situation in Syria being very similar to what happened in the Balkans. And, of course, the Russians were, again, in the situation of supporting the regime that was committing the atrocities, by and large. And then the Russians, conversely, I guess it's in conjunction with this meeting that's taking place to which the United States is not invited, they're calling upon Iran to take a role in ending the 15-month-old conflict in Syria. And, of course, already Hillary Clinton has basically snubbed them, saying that the Iranians are actually helping to manage the repression in Syria. My understanding is that the drones that are being used by the Syrian military have been supplied by the Iranians.
It's funny, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was about to say the same thing, because when I heard about the drones today, I said, these are probably Iranian drones. But look, I think the Russians are being, l'enfant méchant here. I mean, they're really trying to stick it to the United States and to its allies by talking about the Iranians, because they know that this is the third rail of politics in the United States, and the moment you invoke the Iranians, we tend to go bananas, rightly so in the case of Syria. But the truth is, I mean, there must be a way for the Russians and the Americans to agree on something. I mean, the Russians, in the end, are going to lose, and they know it. I was at a conference recently and talked to one of the leading Russian specialists on the Middle East, and this is an old hand, and he understands that they're going to lose. But they're going to resist as long as they can, A, not to give in the United States, B, to essentially show their bona fides, that they don't give up on their allies, and see there's this issue of the domestic politics factor. I mean, Putin cannot be seen, like Medvedev was in Libya, of giving in to the West.
But unless
the West invites the Russians in,
I see,
and makes them a full participant, and I don't think this is going to be solved. And I think we need to be able to say, look, we were wrong maybe in criticizing all this, and you were wrong in terms of supporting the Assad regime to the hilt. Let's come up and work together. And there's nothing wrong with this. I think that the discourse that's coming out of London and Washington at the moment is particularly destructive. I mean, we may not like the Russians. We may think the Russians are not very honest or whatever. But the truth is, they are part of the solution and part of the problem. And without them, this is not going to be solved, except, of course, a huge amount of bloodshed, at which point, and there will be a tipping point in Syria when the Syrians will be sick and tired of killing each other, and they will stop. But is it going to be 100,000 dead, after 100,000 dead, 200,000 dead? We don't know that.
And we don't know how long it will go on. We certainly know that there would be no intervention on the U.S. part until after the election. So it could mean months and months of mayhem until
And in, I mean, I don't think we should look at the elections as the most important event. I mean, I think the United States is tired of military interventions abroad. I think the American public doesn't want it. Mm-hmm. And I think the other issue is, I think the United States should stop not being involved in the Middle East, but being involved in wars in the Middle East. Right, and I think the Obama administration has the right approach in this. We should not be engaged anymore in bombing Muslim populations in the Middle East, whether they're Alawites or Sunni or whatever. Right, let somebody else do it, but let I think it's not the United States that should do it. So I don't think it's a question of the elections. I think even if President Obama gets reelected, I don't think he will intervene militarily after.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Henri Bakke. Again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and recently he had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to the principal author of the Republican Healthcare Plan that was adopted by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts and later by President Obama.
Shut up!